This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks.
And I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This week, 11-term Massachusetts Congressman John Oliver announced he won't seek re-election. Massachusetts is going to lose a House seat anyway, so will this ease the state's redistricting process?
It's somewhat easier, but there's still some real tough decisions that have to be made.
Meanwhile, just 5 weeks after the end of Don't Ask, Don't Tell, gay service members challenged the Defense of Marriage Act in federal district court here in Massachusetts.
While Don't Ask, Don't Tell repeal was an incredible step forward for military equality, an important missing piece of that military equality is family recognition and spousal recognition.
And a Boston Globe investigation of restaurant seafood turns up widespread practices that are, well, pretty fishy.
White tuna was never really tuna or albacore. It was always a fish called escalar, which is known in the industry as the X-lax fish.
We promise to try to keep the pescatorial puns to a minimum in our week in review. And joining us now to review all that news is Renee Loth, columnist for the Boston Globe. Hi there, Renee.
Hi, I'm not promising.
Okay. We'll look out for the fishy puns from Renee. Ken Cooper is also with us. He is a Pulitzer Prize winner and editor of the Trotter Review. Welcome back, Ken.
You, Meghna.
So let's start off with political news, and that is, of course, with the fact that two Massachusetts Democrats are bowing out of the political world for now. Congressman John Oliver announced that he's not going to seek re-election in 2012, and Alan Casey ended his campaign to be the Democratic nominee for United States Senate. So we'll get to the Alan Casey story in just a minute. But first, regarding John Oliver, he's 75 years old. He's been in Massachusetts politics for 40 years. Renee, remind us why Oliver's stepping down and what you make of his decision.
Well, you know, I'm sorry to admit this maybe, but I've been around long enough so that I covered John Oliver when he was a state senator in the 1980s. He's really had an amazing career, a long career. He's a former chemistry professor, not your traditional Paul. He's got a really analytical mind, you know, that I think has come into play in his career. He's stepping down, I think, because it is a good time, but also because there's a lot of pressure on him and on that part of the state and his district. Population is flooding out of the western part of the state, and the center of gravity is moving south and east. And so that's where the population goes. That's where the redistricting pressures are going to be moving. And the western part of the state, his district, is really probably going to be merged into one big district.
So you were saying that he may have stood to lose his seat anyway, but not by virtue of an election.
Well, you know, I think it's a little bit like falling on his sword. You know, somebody was going to have to be sacrificed of the delegation. And, you know, in a way, he's stepping aside. It's kind of an honorable thing to do.
Mm. Ken Cooper, what I found interesting about the district that Congressman Oliver represented is that it's got some of Massachusetts' conservative towns and cities, but he has also been one of the most liberal members of our House delegation. So what do you think his soon-to-be absence means for the Massachusetts delegation as a whole?
Well, one of the important things it means, and doesn't really relate to the nature of his district or its demographics, is that Congressman Oliver is the only member from Massachusetts on the House Appropriations Committee, and not only that, he's the only one who is a ranking minority member, and when Democrats had the majority, he was a cardinal, so-called, one of the 13 cardinals who divide up how the money gets spent. That could have implications for the state, particularly since his subcommittee was transportation, a few needs here in that state, and with that in the state, and also housing and urban development, which also a lot of needs in urban areas around the Commonwealth. Before he was elected, his district, or some permutation of it, was represented by a Republican, Silvio Conti, who was kind of a moderate Republican, well-liked. But there have been shifts where you have liberal populations around places like Amherst and the Pioneer Valley, and also in the Berkshires, where people are retiring in some cases. So I think it will sort of make it certainly a larger district, and its representation is likely to come from further east in the district. And people in the far western part of the state have good reason to worry about the quality and nature of representation they might receive from his successor.
Well, let's talk a little bit more about that, because at the top of the segment, we heard State Representative Michael Moran of Brighton. He's the co-chair of the Redistricting Committee in Massachusetts. We heard him saying that Congressman Oliver's retirement makes things a little easier in figuring out how to draw the new districts, but he also said this.
It doesn't solve all of our problems. there is a movement towards the east, so we have to make sure that we consider all things, not just incumbency, when we are configuring these new districts.
Okay, so we've heard this now twice, that population is moving towards the coast here, which makes a lot of sense. But Renee Loth, do you think that that is going to affect how the committee redraws the districts? And could we possibly see one that might actually elicit maybe another Republican congressman or congresswoman?
Well, the redistricting committee is dominated by Democrats, and so I don't think that would be their first priority. They have
one can always hope for bipartisanship.
They're also, you know, they've also redrawn the map of the state legislative seats, the same committee, and they've done a very good job in, giving more opportunities to minorities to win seats in the state legislature. So, I mean, maybe they'll look toward Republican possibilities. I think, you know, one thing that's interesting that's happening in Olver's, current district is that there's already a challenger, a Democratic challenger, Nusifaro, his name is. He's a former state senator from out there, and he's, you know, quite liberal, quite well-liked, and he's probably going to now be running against, this is not changing his plans, probably going to be running against the incumbent Jim McGovern from the 2nd Congressional District 1, not the 2nd, from the 3rd congressional district, one seat over. So there's going to be, Richard Neal. It sort of depends on how these districts are drawn. Mm-hmm. So there's probably going to be some Democratic contest as well. So I think in general, redistricting is a good time for new people to get in. Women also often get elected when there's a new redistricting that happened in 92. It happened in 2002. So I think, you know, it'd be interesting to see, because things sort of get thrown up in the air and there are just a lot of new possibilities. So it'd be interesting to see how that shakes out.
But on the other hand, Ken, you did touch up on a point of that that residents in Western Massachusetts may see a newly elected congressperson have more of a pull towards eastern parts of the state. Do you feel that people in the western part of the state have reason to worry that their interests will not be served the way they once were after this redistricting process?
Well, I think it's a legitimate concern. I can't predict what will actually happen because we don't know who it's going to be.
I always ask you guys to look into a crystal ball.
Mm-hmm. The one thing I would say about whether he runs against Richard Neal or Jim McGovern, both are senior Democrats with important committee assignments. Jim McGovern, I believe, is on the Rules Committee, which in the House has a lot of power to shape how debate proceeds on the House floor and therefore shape the ultimate product during Republican rule. In fact, some bills have gone into rules and come out completely different and rewritten. I think the Patriot Act is a prominent example of that. And then Richard Neal, I'm sure, is on the House Ways and Means Committee, the tax writing committee with a broad brief that includes Social Security and Medicare and tax and trade policy.
Well, let's move on to talk about the other Democrat who we've mentioned who is no longer going to have a hat in this political season, and that is, of course, Alan Casey. He is the co-founder of City Year. This was his second time around running for the Democratic nomination for United States Senate. And he announced this week that he's going to drop out after perceived frontrunner Elizabeth Warren announced a huge round of fundraising. So let's listen to Alan Casey.
And it was clear, you know, she'd raised over $3 million. And some people approached me, good friends, who said, you know, is this really doable? And she's got a lot of support, and you guys share progressive values.
So, Renee and Ken, on the one hand, this almost seemed inevitable given the amount of media attention and money that Elizabeth Warren has elicited since she first said, yes, she's going to run. But on the other hand, we've got 10 months. Is it a good thing that so many people are just dropping out of the Democratic race so soon?
Well, you know, it is interesting that, as they say, the old expression, politics ain't beanbag. So you have to have some, you know, thick skin or some guts to get into it. But it must drive the other Democrats in this primary crazy how Elizabeth Warren has just taken all of the energy and all the money out of the room. I mean, the headline in the Globe about Casey dropping out said, Warren rival drops out. I mean, you know, he's not Warren's rival. He's one of, you know, five Democrats seeking the nomination to run against Scott Brown. You know, so I mean, she just dominates everything. And, you know, some people think it would have been better for her if she is the presumptive nominee. And I'm just not going to go there yet. To have had a little bit of a feistier Democratic Party primary challenge than she's probably going to get now, because the other candidates who are still in the race are much less experienced. You know, others say, you know, why not just, you know, consolidate all the power and money now so that she can, you know, rest up for the fall.
You know, Ken, on the other hand, for quite some time, I mean, my sense was that Alan Casey was the strongest opposition to Elizabeth Warren because he has lots of experience sort of creating networks on the ground, grassroots efforts. He was raising some money, not vast amounts, but he was doing fairly well. And he's, you know, he's been through the ringer before in another Senate race. So now that he's out, I mean, this seems like we're not going to call her the presumptive nominee yet, but now there may be even more pressure on Elizabeth Warren to really prove that she's a good campaigner.
Yeah. The thing I wonder about is that the future debates.
Yeah, how is she going to get battle tested?
And, I mean, to be fair, none of the other candidates have her public stature.
Right.
And if she participates in debates, as we would hope she would, you know, it's kind of an unfortunate expression, but, you know, there's been times in presidential primaries when there was a lot of crowded stage and, you know, a giant and a bunch of midgets. And does that make the giant look better or not? So I think Alan Casey's decision was a realistic one. It was a matter of realism. It sort of speaks to him perhaps also being a loyal Democrat. He said he didn't receive any pressure. But I wonder if he received some inducements. I know the White House was involved in helping shape the field the first time around to replace Senator Kennedy, and the seat's got bound now. And I can't imagine, if not the White House, then the Democratic National Committee weren't conveying some messages.
Well, let's move on to another major topic of the week, and that is a challenge on the Defense of Marriage Act that has come from members of the military. Here is David McKean. He is legal director for Service Members Legal Defense Network, which filed the suit on behalf of Massachusetts National Guard plaintiffs.
Casey, because she can't get a military ID, can't take the children on post to see doctors, can't take the children to school if they were to go to school on post. She can't go shopping at the military commissary for the family.
And that's him referring to Major Shannon McLaughlin, an active member of the Massachusetts National Guard, and her wife, Casey McLaughlin. Renee Loth, I'm throwing all sorts of names around today. It's Friday, isn't it? Renee, your reaction to this latest challenge on the Defense of Marriage Act?
Well, you know, I think it's inevitable. You know, Martha Coakley also has been, you know, challenging the act in on a somewhat different
on a states' rights issue.
Right.
She won that case.
Yes. And I think, frankly, this, you know, legislation is not long for this world. I mean, it's just the polls are now, you know, more than half showing that Americans support gay marriage. There are a lot of personal stories that everybody seems to know somebody who is in a bad situation because of the federal restrictions. And I just think the Congress is not going to change it, but the courts certainly could.
Ken, the other case that Renee referred to, even though Attorney General Martha Coakley won it, it's in appeal right now, likely headed to the Supreme Court. Do you feel that this case emerging from members of the military is likely to go the same way?
Well, it depends on a little bit of which case gets where first. Mm-hmm. It's further behind. It'll take longer to litigate than others that are already under appeal. And it also depends on how the Supreme Court decides to play this and how long they let this issue play out at the appellate level, appellate circuit level in particular, before they decide that they should take a case. And then they may take cases that are consolidated. I mean, Brown versus Board of Education was a consolidation of five cases.
Hmm.
And the six was treated somewhat differently because it had to do with the District of Columbia. I mean, I think this the National Guard case in humanizing what the impact is, and in a slightly different way, it shows how awfully unfair it is to these families. It costs them extra for health insurance for the civilian partner in these marriages. Lack of access to the commissary where everything is cheaper. It just does not seem fair. And I don't know if the Defense Department could ever write a policy to get around the Defense of Marriage Act. without violating that act.
It did seem inevitable that a case like this would emerge in the 5 or so months we have since the end of Don't Ask, Don't Tell in the military anyway. But we'll see where that goes. There's one more story I want to hit before we get to our hubbubs. Are you ready with your puns, Renee? This is, of course, about the Boston Globe's major investigation that the fact that a lot of seafood in Massachusetts restaurants isn't what the restaurateurs say it might be. We did a follow-up discussion with Chef Jasper White. He runs the Summer Shack, and he knows a lot about fish. He said, you know, there was discussion of should there be more inspection of what's actually being served, what's coming off boats. He actually made an appeal not to get inspectors involved between the restaurant and the ocean from where these fish come.
We can't put another layer in by having the government checking stuff coming off the boats, slowing it down 8 hours so they miss the day and it goes to market a day late. I mean, this fish is at its best within 30 hours of catching it.
Renee and Ken, briefly, I mean, this one just seems like a consumer beware story.
Yeah, I mean, I actually agree with Jasper White on this, you know, I think consumers have haddock with fish being presented as something that it is not. But,
oh, my God. I'm sorry.
And, you know, Congressman Markey has, Ed Markey has opened a congressional investigation into this and trying to get the, you know, federal inspectors to, you know, become involved. And I just think it's difficult to, with a product that needs to be fresh, as Jasper White said, to, you know, interleave another layer of government inspection. I really, and also, you know, really no one can detect a switch in the kitchen. Mm-hmm. I mean, unless the inspectors come right into the, you know, kitchen with the chefs. So really it's something of a consumer beware situation. And, you know, the Globe spent 5 months investigating this. I think it came, you know, there was a high interest on the part of the readership, and people are just going to start quizzing their weight people, you know, pretty hard now about where the origins and the provenance of the fish.
Ken, I don't know if you eat fish, but does this make you feel like you're going to do a double take next time you're at a restaurant?
Well, I eat a lot of fish, actually. It's a big part of my diet, and I insist on fresh. Nearly all of the time. I don't, however, dine much in restaurants, but when I'm buying fresh fish, I'm going to pay more attention and ask more questions and, you know, maybe change who I buy from. There's a small mom-and-pop fish market in Quincy where I often go to get a fish sandwich to eat there, but they sell fresh fish, and they've been in business for 50 years.
Yeah.
I would trust them.
Well, that's actually something that Anthony brought up when he did that segment, and we spoke to a local fishmonger. But Anthony, speaking of,
yeah,
hubbub time, yours first.
Just for the halibut. Okay. All right, sorry. So my hubbub, the intersection of two really pressing issues that relate to the health of our democracy, the right to free speech in New Hampshire, and Bigfoot sightings on Mount Monadnock. I just love this story, Renee, and I give credit, of course, to the Boston Globe for picking it up this week, but it was below the fold. So for folks that missed this story, this is about Jonathan Doyle, a man named Jonathan Doyle, who took to dressing up as Bigfoot and running around the top of Mount Monadnock and then filming people responding to Bigfoot sightings and posting it on YouTube. And let's listen to a bit of what he did.
So, okay, what is it that you saw?
I saw a big, hairy, man-like creature on top of Mount Manhattan.
You did?
Yeah. Well, at first I thought it was just a man in a suit making some sort of movie mockumentary.
Anyway, at first I thought it was a guy in a suit making a mockumentary about Bigfoot, and that's what it was. So when Doyle went back to sort of do an encore presentation, the park rangers kicked him off of Mount Monadnock. And he took the case to court, and the New Hampshire Civil Liberties Foundation has picked up the case. It's now before the highest court in New Hampshire. And I just want to read you John Doyle's as quoted in the Globe. I'm maintaining the integrity of being real, enjoying day-to-day things, and having fun with your friends, Doyle said in an interview. If I let that go, I've given up a significant right to the state. This is a very important case.
And if your idea of fun is getting dressed up as a Sasquatch and climbing Mount
Manhattan. Anyway, I love that story.
You know what? He'll be for Halloween.
Yes, exactly.
Ken, your hubbub?
Yeah, I'm going to stick with the politics and go local, as they say all politics are. In Boston, the city council race is coming up November the 3rd. There's one open seat at play, and that's in the eastern part of Dorchester District 3. Longtime councilor Maureen Feeney is retiring. It's been whittled down into the runoff between Frank Baker and John O'Toole, who are first-time candidates from different parts of the majority white part of the district. That matters because the district is actually, voting age population is actually 55% minority. And there's been questions about the quality of representation to the non-majority white parts of the district. And one thing that distinguishes John O'Toole from Frank Baker is that about a dozen years ago, John O'Toole joined with other parents, all of them white, I believe, and sued the Boston school system to eliminate race as a criterion in student assignments. They didn't succeed. There was a settlement. The policy was modified. But O'Toole said he sued, or at least his wife said then that they sued because their son didn't get into the kindergarten. That was the family's first choice.
Interesting. Renee, your hubbub?
Well, first it was Friendly's Ice Cream, and now another popular regional chain is closing in Massachusetts, Daddy's Junkie Music, a favorite of Berkeley students for 39 years, shut its doors this week. It had 12 stores on Mass Avenue and near Berkeley and in New Hampshire and some of the North Shore suburbs. But it's interesting because the villain in this piece, at least from some perspectives, is none other than Mitt Romney. Because it was Romney's Bain Capital that bought Daddy's Junkie Music's competitor, Guitar Center, and heavily capitalized. Guitar Center was able to put Daddy's Junkie Music out of business. So I don't know if Romney is looking for this vote, but I think he could probably pretty much write off the headbanger and heavy metal vote, at least in New England.
Oh, he's lost that vote. Oh, no. Renee Loth, columnist for the Boston Globe. Great to have you, as always.
Thank you.
And Ken Cooper, Pulitzer Prize winner and editor of the Trotter Review. Thank you as well.
Thank you.